You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. The Nationals well on their way to clinching the division title, but the Mets very much alive in the wild card. They've played themselves right into the thick of things, currently holding a spot as the playoffs get closer and closer. So let's start with MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo. Anthony, a tough loss on Monday, a game that got away early against the Nationals, but we can't take anything away from the week that was, a week in which the Mets played two bad teams in the Reds and the Braves, and they took care of business going 5-1. I think I said on the podcast last week, this is a really a stretch where they need to go 4-2 or better, and 5-1 is certainly better. So with that, the Mets now own the second wild card spot in the National League. Slight edge over the Cardinals at this point as we record the podcast. Game and a half back of the Giants. But Monday night got away early because Rafael Montero struggled to throw strikes. He goes an inning and two-thirds, 5 hits, 6 earned runs. Is he running out of chances as far as the 2016 Mets go in this rotation as guys start to get healthy?
Oh, he's run out of chances, and it has nothing to do with health at this point. He's made 3 starts down the stretch now. Wildness has been a critical problem in all of them, and the Mets managed to win the first two more in spite of what Rafael Montero did than because of him. So Monday was it for him. He you know, you walked in 2 runs at the first inning. He gave up 2 home runs in the second inning, and the Mets were never really in the game out of that. And you can you can quibble about Terry Collins' decision to leave Montero in the game after the first inning. His batting slot came up, and he certainly could have been gone at that point. But this is still on Montero. He had the opportunity to pitch. He did not pitch well enough, and he is going to be gone. Now the question becomes, who replaces him? Because the Mets don't have a ton of options. They do have an 8-man pitching staff right now, but not a lot of options in there that you would say, this is the guy we want to start the game, with 2 notable exceptions. One is Jacob deGrom, the other is Steven Matz. Both are nursing injuries, and there's really a little uncertainty as we stand here on Tuesday afternoon recording this podcast as to which or either or both of those guys might be ready. Both have been throwing off a mound. Jacob deGrom played catch today on Tuesday after a mound session Monday and said he felt okay after it. Steven Matz has been down in Florida rehabbing from his shoulder impingement, and he also is trying to get back sooner rather than later. It's certainly possible we could see one of those guys start that game. It's also possible they could both pitch in that game in a sort of a piggyback situation, because neither, frankly, at this point is stretched out long enough to go 6 or 7 innings by themselves. And the third option, of course, is it's entirely possible either of them might be ready, in which case the Mets could either go bullpen game, given how many arms they have down there, or they could just skip the slot altogether and move everyone else up. They have an off day on Thursday, which would allow them to do that. It's not an ideal situation because a lot of these guys are going on fumes right now in the rotation, having pitched so many innings, and certainly the Mets are in a pennant race, and that's part of what got them in this predicament to begin with. But a short answer to a long one would be there's a lot of options, there's a lot of balls in the air right now, and most of it depends upon the health of Steven Matz and Jacob deGrom.
When you look at those options, by far the most entertaining and interesting option is for both of them to pitch, because that's thinking outside the box, I think, Anthony. And I think the more of that we have in baseball, the better. To be able to go with Matz and deGrom in a start and kind of split the lifting, and then they're both kind of getting some innings in. To me, that's great thinking on the part of the Mets, and it would be fascinating to see how it worked out and something that maybe other teams look at as they get guys back, because you know neither guy is going to go deep into a game. So if each of them could throw 3 innings, 4 innings, there you go.
Well, I mean, the way the Mets are looking at it is these guys have reached the point now where they're at full strength, or at least something close to full strength, throwing off mounds on the side in the bullpen. So why not spend those bullets in an actual game? The counter argument is, well, you could start Jacob deGrom, but he might only be able to give you, say, 3 innings, even if everything goes great. And I think that's what they're looking at and saying, fine, give us those 3 innings in a game. And then if Steven Matz is in the same situation, maybe he can give us three of his own. And then we get into the later innings and you can mix and match however you like. That's the ideal situation. And I think that's the way they're looking at it is, look, let's suspend these bullets at the big league level because we are in a pennant race. We are playing games that matter. And why put out the Rafael Monteros or the Gabriel Noahs or the Sean Gilmartins or whoever it might be of the world, have them start those games when we have Jacob DeGrom, a rookie of the year, a perennial Cy Young contender, and Stephen Matz, who was himself a rookie of the year candidate this year before injuries took over. Why not start those guys instead? I think certainly there's a very compelling argument for it. But again, as I feel like I've said every week on this podcast, they have to be ready. They have to be healthy. The Mets can't rush them back just because those are the names that they want pitching in a pennant race. They have to be the best options, and they will only be that if they really are truly, honestly healthy enough to pitch and pitch at a high level, pitch at 100% or at least something close to it. That's what the Mets are willing to see. That's what they will find out in the coming days. And, yeah, it could make for an interesting, fun game if it winds up being that we see Jacob DeGrom and Stephen Matz pitch back-to-back in the same game.
I think one benefit maybe you have in that situation is you don't want your starters to guys that are ingrained in your rotation like Matz and DeGrom. You don't necessarily want to be using them out of the bullpen, something they're not as used to. But if they know, say you go into the game and you know, hey, Jacob's going to go three innings, I mean, to a degree, Matz can probably prep like it's a start, knowing when he's kind of going to get the ball, as opposed to we're not sure when we'll bring you in, but hopefully you can help us at some point. There could be more of a set preparation as far as his scheduling and getting ready, not for a 7:05 start, but maybe for a 8:05 or 8:10 entrance into the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And more than anything, you know, even if you had just Jacob DeGrom pitching in relief of someone else, which was a possibility earlier this week, you don't want these starting pitchers in a situation where they have to come in with runners on the corners and two outs and get you out of a jam. That's not what they're used to doing, and not saying Jacob DeGrom or Stephen Matz couldn't do that, but these guys are creatures of habit, certainly, and they're used to taking a long time to warm up for games. Sometimes the stretching for some of these guys will start hours before a 7:05 start. You know, they will throw quite a few more pitches in a bullpen before a game than a reliever would. So, yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. For guys knowing, even though they're in the bullpen, that they're going to come in roughly a certain time. They're going to start an inning, zero outs, no one on the bases, and it'll be very much like a start for Stephen Matz or Jacob DeGrom if that's what it winds up being. So it's definitely going to be something to look out for. I think certainly it will give the Mets a boost of energy, of adrenaline, of optimism if it winds up that they're playing one of these games in a pennant race here. And all of a sudden they have Jacob DeGrom and Stephen Matz as options on the mound, which they haven't had for all of September. I think it would be a very nice thing for the Mets. But again, health comes first, and that's what the Mets are gauging right now.
Mark, a couple of weeks to go here for the Braves before they really start to look to the future, and that includes all sorts of stuff as they try to get this roster ready to turn things around and get back to winning baseball, open the new ballpark next spring. We're going to get into all of that stuff. Let's start with a couple of trades the team, though, made on Wednesday. They get Josh Colemanter for cash from the Cubs. They get Joe Wieland for cash as well from the Mariners. A couple of pitchers, one more experienced than the other in Colemanter. What's the mindset for the Braves, though, in making these moves to bring in these veteran pitchers who their teams had kind of given up on?
Yeah, I mean, basically just trying to survive for the rest of the season. They lost Williams Perez and Mike Foltynewicz to injuries there on Sunday and Monday. I don't expect Perez to make another start this year. Folty, we'll see. I mean, he might get down to the point where he can make another start after he recovers from that bruised calf that he suffered the other night. But, you know, then you have to ask the question, do you really want him to put himself as an injury risk? You know, does it make sense just for one start to have him go out there? So they signed Wieland basically just to fill some space in with Gwinnett because they've got for the rest of their playoffs. There's a chance he comes up. Colemanter, yeah, it does seem like he'll be up maybe even as early as tomorrow. There's a chance he starts Saturday. It's basically just to survive for the rest of this year, you know, given the amount of injuries that they're dealing with within their rotation. So I don't necessarily, you know, these guys probably won't even be with the club more than a week or two. But But at the same time, it's just one of those just survive the rest of the year and don't put Folty in a position where he, you know, you're just throwing him out there and risking a further injury.
Yeah, you have to get to that final game of the season. They don't let you just throw in the white flag here in mid-September. You mentioned the Triple-A team Gwinnett in the playoffs. The Braves single-A, double-A, and triple-A teams all in championship series, which is cool to see because even when you have prospects, it doesn't necessarily mean they're winning on their way up through the minor leagues. But for the Braves to have that much success in the minor leagues, you would hope it gives these guys kind of that taste of winning as they make their way to Atlanta and certainly can't hurt this organization going forward.
No doubt about it. I mean, and that's – I think you said it best is – you can have a lot of talent. That doesn't mean you're going to win at the minor league level. But when they do win together, that's just a great experience for them for pitchers to be able to pitch in some higher stress situations. You know, it just takes them a little bit closer to what they may experience once they get to the big league level. And then also, you know, if they are fortunate enough to win at the big league level, it's, you know, they at least have had a taste of what a postseason might feel like. The scene is much different at the big league level, but at the same time, there are people that say winning is addictive. You start winning as a group. You saw it with some of the Braves teams late 1980s, early 1990s, then all those kids that were Chipper Jones and Brian Klesko, Javi Lopez, and, you know, those guys that were coming up within a few years of each other, they won together down there and then ended up winning up here. You had a little bit of that with Brian McCann, Jeff Francoeur, at Rome together. I think Kyle Davies may have been on that team as well. So there are no guarantees, you know, but at the same time, you know, when you get a chance to get a taste of something like that, the minor league level, yeah, it can be very beneficial for some of these young prospects.
Bill, the Nationals' magic number 7 right now, which means you're getting really close to some champagne in the clubhouse for this Washington Nationals team. And let's start. We'll get through some different stuff, Strasburg's health, how good Tanner Roark's been. I want to touch on some different stuff. But I want to start with Daniel Murphy because the Nationals playing the Mets again on Wednesday. Daniel Murphy got another hit. So he pretty much completes a perfect season against his former team, Bill. 19 games played, and he had 19 hits against the Mets. As good as he's been all year for the Nationals, it just seems like he's a guy that knows when he can – make a bigger point, or when the lights are brighter, he rises to the occasion, and he certainly did that against his former team.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, if you think about it, the Mets, you know, kind of like gave up on Daniel Murphy. They kind of made up their minds early that he wasn't going to come back to New York. But he's proven that, you know, he's more than just a hitter. He can drive in runs. He can hit home runs. He's having his best year ever. And it's carried over from last year's postseason. And that's, you know, it's obviously Mets made a mistake by letting him go.
They certainly did. He's actually hitting over 400 against the Mets this season. All right, I mentioned Strasburg, and there's still a lot of question marks, Bill. Obviously, it's unclear if he's going to be ready to pitch at all for this team this season, postseason, late in the regular season. What is the plan as far as trying to figure this out and trying to have an idea of how there may be some availability for Steven Strasburg?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Well, first of all, they need the swelling on the flexor mass to go down. Then he's going to get a second opinion, and then they'll figure out how far he can go. But to be honest with you, Tim, I don't see him coming back at all, not this year anyway, because – if you look at the history of the Nationals under Mike Rico, I've never known them to rush an arm. They've never rushed an arm. So I just think that, you know, you have, what, 2 weeks left to go, 3 weeks maybe, and I just don't see them rushing Strasburg just to play in the postseason. I just don't see it.
It's kind of remarkable that you think of Steven Strasburg obviously missing the postseason the year he was shut down, and now the team wins another division, and it looks like they're going to be without Steven Strasburg again in the postseason. Just terrible luck, and you know it's got to be killing Strasburg inside. The good news for this team, though, Bill, is when you look at this rotation and you take into account that you need less starters once you get to October, they're still in pretty good shape. I think this team still has the starting pitching to get to the World Series.
I totally agree with you. It's not the starting pitching I'm worried about. I'm more worried about the bullpen. I mean, I think they have enough starters. You only need like three starters anyway. I mean, first of all, it's going to be Max Scherzer, Tanner Roark, and, you know, most likely Gio Gonzalez, although I think it wouldn't surprise me if A.J. Cole was given the chance. But I think the biggest concern for me is, can the bullpen be a shutdown bullpen? I mean, when I look at this bullpen, I don't see it as a shutdown bullpen. So you hope that it can help the Nationals go past at least the first round, the division series.
You hope that maybe somebody who's not in the rotation in the playoffs can help out the bullpen as well. We'll have to see. But you mentioned Tanner Roark, 7 scoreless frames again on Wednesday, Bill. And I mean, 15 wins now, but somehow I feel like this guy still isn't getting the credit he deserves.
Well, especially after the year he had last year. I mean, he had a bad year. It wasn't his fault, really. He lost his job. It wasn't because of performance. It's because Max Scherzer showed up. And I credit Dusty Baker, because Dusty Baker gave him the confidence, you know, to get his mojo back. And it's really good to see him become one of the top starters. And you know, when it's all said and done, he's probably going to pitch in the second game of the division series. So, I mean, he is one of the best pitchers around now. I mean, he did it in 2014, but this year I think he's even better.
Todd, the Phillies have taken 2 of 3 from the cross-state rival Pirates here heading into Thursday's series finale, and they've gotten some good starts from the young pitchers over the last stretch here, kind of back-to-back. It's been Adam Morgan in the last series, Alec Asher, Jake Thompson have all turned in good performances. When you see that happen, are these guys starting to maybe feed off each other a little bit in that rotation?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly it's a good sign as the season kind of winds down, because I'll be honest, you know, the rotation looked really good early in the season when they got off to that 24-17 start. Then Aaron Nola got hurt, then Zach Eflin got hurt, and Vince Velasquez was really struggling, and then Jake Thompson came up, and he really got hit hard his first 4 starts. And all of a sudden you're sitting there going, oh boy, like, what do they have going into next season? It didn't really look good at one point. So to see Asher and Morgan and Thompson and Eichhoff start, you know, pitch well recently, and if they can continue to pitch like this, I think it'll give the Phillies coaching staff, Pete McCann, the front office, a little bit more of a positive feeling, but certainly right now they're in a pretty good role.
Yeah, and Eichhoff getting the ball in the series finale against the Pirates here on Thursday night. A couple of guys have come up from the minor leagues, adding to the team that had already been added to here in September, but Roman Quinn's back up with the team after he had briefly come up to make his major league debut. Also, Jorge Alfaro. Now, Quinn's a fun guy in the fact that you don't see a lot of players, Todd, with that kind of speed, that kind of, I guess you could call it, game-changing speed, where a guy can really have an impact with his legs.
He is blazing fast. I got to see him a little bit in spring training, and the coaches were really impressed. I mean, not that my opinion matters to the coaches, but I was impressed. And he's made a few plays so far this week since his promotion that have really been fun to watch. Beating out bunts for base hits, advancing to second base on a wild pitch that only got away from the catcher a few feet, scoring from third after coming to a stop when a ball was hitting a shallow right center field. Things that maybe Cesar Hernandez could have done, but really not too many players on this team or anybody in baseball could have done. And they're looking for players like that, so Pete McCann said earlier this week that he will play Roman Quinn a good bit the rest of the season, and he said last night that if Roman continues to play well, it's not out of the question that he could be on the opening day roster. I think a lot of people thought that even if he played well, he probably would open the season in AAA, since he's really missed so much time in the minor leagues because of injuries. But, hey, if he steps up and he plays well this season and he has a good spring training, they're looking for players right now, and he can establish himself as one. And another thing he did on Wednesday night's game is he threw out a runner at the plate in the ninth inning, and according to StatCast, the throw was clocked at 96.1 miles an hour, and that was the strongest throw by any Phillies outfielder this season, assist or otherwise. So not only can he run and hit a little bit, but he can also gun some people out at the plate.
Yeah, impressive stuff. And so he came up from Double-A, as did Alfaro. Redding knocked out of the Eastern League postseason. Alfaro, obviously the catcher of the future, I guess we could give him that title. You said Quinn, if he continues to hit, could be on this roster as early as opening day in 2017. How far away is Alfaro? Because I know the development of a catcher is a little more complicated.
Yeah, it is. And everything I've heard about, well, there's two things I think indicates that he will start the season again in the minor leagues, and maybe the Phillies go out and find a veteran catcher to kind of back up Cameron Rupp. Maybe, you know, maybe they bring back AJ Ellis if AJ Ellis would want to re-sign here. One is, I've heard a lot of things about he's got a lot of room to grow in terms of calling a game. So he might not be there yet in terms of handling a big league pitching staff. And the second thing is, which is really a problem with some of the Phillies' top prospects, is he strikes out a lot and really doesn't walk too much. So I think if he can kind of work on that maybe a little bit next season in the minor leagues, you know, he could be up at some point. But certainly the Phillies remain very, very high on him. He's a great athlete. He's got incredible power. He's got an incredible arm. And if he can just kind of hone in on a couple other things and improve on a couple other things that I mentioned, I think he'll be up at some point next year.
Joe, the Marlins lose a wild one on Monday to the Braves, obviously a team that they need to beat if they're going to stay alive in the playoff race, which is, it's kind of life support right now. Five games out of the wild card with just 3 weeks basically to play. They showed fight in that game, getting back into it after getting down really early. That was good to see. What wasn't good to see, Joe, was Andrew Cashner struggling again on the mound.
Yeah, I mean, they were in a 7-run hole in the third inning. And what, as you noted, Tim, they made a really good comeback. What could have been, you know, one of, you know, their best win of the year, coming back from 7 down and winning on a night that everyone in front of them lost, could have really kind of sent a signal to those in front that, hey, you know, we better keep playing. And, you know, it turns into a demoralizing loss because they took it all the way back to 7-7, only to give up a 2-out hit to Nick Markakis, who has completely killed the Marlins all season long. So obviously a lot of frustration from the pitching, and as you noted, Andrew Cashner. And, you know, he kept looking at that finger. He'd been dealing with this blister issue for several weeks, or about a month or a little more. They all insist that's not the issue. But, you know, he had won this previous start, showed some good positive signs in that one, and, you know, just didn't really give the team much of a chance last night, you know, with that outing. And it makes you wonder if he will still remain in the rotation, or if they feel they need to you know, go with someone else, as they, you know, they're going to fight as long as they're in it, you know, and you know, see what happens. Stranger things have happened, but obviously, you know, coming into Atlanta, a team that's really, their talk is not to lose 100, and the Marlins' talk is to get to the postseason. They take 2 of 3 over the weekend against the Dodgers, and what 6 of 7 against the Dodgers, and they're what 9 and, you know, 4-9. The Braves won 9 of those 13 in the season series, so. Very difficult, very crushing loss for the Marlins as they, you know, make one last gasp to try to be in this.
Injury to insult a little bit as Marcelo Ozuna leaves the game with a knee bruise. He was hit by a pitch in the fourth inning in that game, and still unsure how serious that injury is and whether he'll be able to get back into the lineup quickly.
Yeah, Tim, that's a little interesting one. You know, he did stay in the game, and he ran the bases. He scored a run. That was the 5-run fourth inning where the Marlins, you know, got pretty much all of it back. And he actually had the at-bat that hit Fulton Winich. I don't want to mispronounce his name. I don't know. I just did. He hit him in the lower leg in a very ironic twist after he gets hit by a pitch that he's the one that delivers 100. And that was 110 miles an hour, shows, according to StatCast, shows how scary those incidents are. But Mattingly noted he wanted to get him out of there because he feared that knee would lead to some swelling and discomfort, and they wanted to kind of treat it right away in hopes of getting him back maybe as early as today. But usually history shows that guys don't come back that quickly. And with September call-ups, you got a lot of reinforcements there that can play. But I think that the curious thing, Tim, about that one is it happened when the inning after the Braves go up 7, and first pitch of the inning, and when we go back and look at the game at Fort Bragg on July 3rd in the 9th inning, AJ Ramos hit Flowers in the head or upper shoulder in the neck area with a pitch in that game, and Flowers got hit several times, I think, by the Marlins this year, and I can't help but wonder if the timing of it, that there wasn't a payback pitch. And, if so, and the Marlins lose Ozuna for any period of time, it's, just part of the game where, you hit their guy, they hit your guy, So a little history to that, then I'm not so sure that wasn't a purpose pitch.